This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Help wanted, addiction counselors. As overdose deaths continue to climb in New Hampshire, there's been a statewide call for more access to drug treatment, and more funding for it has come through. But despite rising demand, treatment centers are scrambling to find and keep enough trained staff. For years, this field has suffered from chronic turnover due to low pay and high stress. Addiction counseling can be rewarding, but also emotionally demanding. Patients often relapse, and failure to recover can lead to death. It's no surprise, then, that nationally, each year, roughly one out of every four substance abuse clinicians chooses to leave the job. Today in The Exchange, a severe shortage in substance abuse treatment staffing and efforts here in New Hampshire to ease it. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests in studio. Emily Corwin is here, NHPR's Seacoast reporter. She's been covering this issue of substance abuse staffing. And Emily, thank you for helping us out.
Thanks, Laura.
Also with us, Diane Pepin, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Alcohol and Drug Abuse Counselors Association. And Diane, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, too.
Also with us, Melissa Chickering, formerly a program director at Phoenix House, now a faculty member at Antioch University in the Applied Psychology Department. She's also an adjunct at Keene State. And Melissa, good to meet you. Thank you also for being here.
Thank you.
Well, Emily, I do want to start with you. First of all, just how bad is the turnover?
It's pretty significant. As you mentioned, one in four counselors switches jobs each year. Many of them are leaving the field. And if you look at the number of licensed counselors in New Hampshire, it's almost even the number letting their licenses expire. This is specifically for the substance abuse counselor license, as people gaining that license. So there's really no net gain in a field that really needs it.
So people are entering almost at the same rate as they are leaving.
Yes.
At a time when, Emily, just describe for us, the demand is rising.
Right. I mean, we hear about these numbers every day, but, you know, there's just a increase in the number of people with opiate addiction, and they have increasing access because of Medicaid expansion, because of some of the rules in the Affordable Care Act, the parity law. All of this is and will be giving people increasing access, which means that, you know, if you're even just static with the number of providers, you're going to be at a loss.
It's almost like access in name only, Emily, right? I mean, you know, you have access, you have coverage, but if you can't find somebody to help you, you don't really have access, do you?
Right. And, you know, some of the clinical directors I've talked to have said that, you know, without that counselor they've been trying to hire forever, they just can't accept as many people.
Well, and Diane, so let's hear from you on this. Again, you are Executive Director of the New Hampshire Alcohol and Drug Abuse Counselors Association. What's your perspective on this staff shortage?
For the longest time, it's been considered that substance abuse counselors, it's an aging profession, that the people who started off working in it are getting older and they're retiring or they're moving on. And if burnout hasn't gotten to them, you know, they're looking to do policy and administrative type work, or they're getting ready to retire. So the number of people coming in, they come in a lot slower than what they leave, even though from Emily's research, it's evening out. It takes a while to get a credential for substance abuse.
Why are people leaving?
I think a majority of why they're leaving would be that they're burnt out. If they're leaving, it's a hard, demanding job. It's difficult to put everything into what you're doing, and there's no guarantee that the person that you're serving is going to make it.
Regardless of your best efforts.
Regardless of your best efforts. People die, and it's critical. And it's a heavy load to be carrying that critical nature as a profession.
Melissa, you've dealt with this yeah. idea of working really hard, trying your best, and sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think that in many ways is the nature of addiction. So in our training, when we go through our, undergraduate or graduate programs, we learn about addiction and we have a lot of training around, what to expect, and that success rates are not high, and that, there's an 80% chance of relapse when you're working with a client.
80%?
Yeah, but I think that it's really important to also note that it's not just that you're working with a client and you're like, there might not be this glowing success that I'm hoping for. I think that the other reason that counselors are really experiencing a lot of compassion fatigue is because the system that we're also working in has roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. So you're working with a client, and when they do make progress, it's within this system that puts up roadblock after roadblock for them to continue to do well. A lot of people see this in the jail systems. I worked mostly with adolescents. I saw it all the time in the probation systems for adolescents. I think that many counselors experience burnout or compassion fatigue, but I think specifically in New Hampshire in the substance abuse field, I think it is also this incredible frustration with the system, the lack of services, the lack of funding that's available.
Well, give us a little bit more on sort of the roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. What are you talking about there, Melissa?
I'm talking about like having a client, for example, when I was working in a treatment facility, I would have a client that we would bring into treatment, and say they were a client that they were an IV heroin user at the age of 17. You would think that you would have plenty of time to work with that client, to work with their family, the very complicated situations. And instead, what you end up seeing is that as soon as the funding stops, the client, regardless of what the situation is, regardless of how much the client wants to get better, regardless of their family situation, all of those things, they go right back home. And there's an incredible lack of services in the schools. There's an incredible lack of family services. And so really, we end up abandoning these clients. And I think that for clinicians, and I know for myself, seeing these clients that worked so hard with a really terrible disease fall on their face because the system just sort of eliminated a lot of the funding and a lot of the support that they needed is devastating as a counselor.
Why does the funding and support stop?
I think that when things are going well and a state experiences some budget cuts, it is really easy for the state to say, and I'm speaking of state in like a very broad sense, but it's very easy for the state to say, we should eliminate that funding from addicts because there's a huge stigma around what it means to be an addict. Let's be honest, addicts don't do nice things. They are not always super likable, especially when they're in the throes of addiction. So it's very easy for them to say, okay, let's eliminate that funding. And in around 2010, 2011, we saw that in New Hampshire with the elimination of the cigarette tax, with them not providing the full funding for the alcohol fund, which I think they are revising, which is fantastic and wonderful. And I think that because addiction has such a high recidivism rate, it's really easy for people to just sort of throw their hands in the air and say, well, it's not going to work anyway.
I'm not making a difference with that 80%.
Yeah, so
relapse rate you talk about.
Exactly. Yeah, they're not going to get better anyway. And so then they end up putting them in jails, which costs twice as much as treatment anyway. So it's, yeah.
Right. So the people who are looking for the funding and really working hard at that. And right now there is more funding available and there is a lot of push and a lot of understanding and a broader perspective of addiction because addiction isn't discriminating. You know, it's hitting everybody, and it's hitting a lot of people. Now I've forgotten the point that I was starting to try to make.
Well, that things have changed since 2010 in a way, because there's more recognition and more funding. But what seems to not have changed, Diane, is that you're still not getting enough good trained people in this field to take care of addicts.
Right. There's a process in getting that to happen. So there are quick ways of doing it and not so quick ways of doing it. The not so quick is if someone decides they're going to be a master's level clinician and they start school in a bachelor's program or an associate's degree program, and then they work their way through up all of those years of education, and then they have to have a number of experience hours working in the profession before they can get even qualify for the credential to show they have minimum understanding and minimum experience. So that's the slow way. The quicker way would be someone who's already credentialed in a mental health field, who already has the master's degree, already has a lot of the experience. They need to fill out the application and show or demonstrate proficiency in substance abuse. And so that is much quicker to help someone get into the profession if they've already got that base to start with.
Well, we should definitely talk a little bit later about what it takes, the educational process, and so forth. But go ahead, Emily. You want to jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted in the question of, you know, why is there this shortage? I mean, you guys should let me know if I'm wrong on this, but I think that we probably haven't emphasized enough pay. Addiction counselors with, 4 years of school, no masters, make, you know, 30 to 40, I believe, less. Melissa says less. I've been told that if you have your master's, you can make 40 these days. I've heard even 50. Am I wrong?
I think 50 would be incredibly generous.
Okay. All right. So as you can tell, they make very little. And even though the Bureau of Labor Statistics they don't break it down well enough to be able to say with certainty. It's relatively clear, at least anecdotally, that addiction counselors who have the same education, you know, the same qualifications, are earning less than counselors in mental health fields that are not addiction with the same credentials.
So high stress and low pay. Melissa.
So I'm a master's licensed alcohol and drug counselor and also a licensed clinical mental health counselor in the state of New Hampshire. And the MLADAC, which is the master's licensed alcohol and drug counselor, it is such an important license in the state. And I know the board has done all of this work to really make it more legitimate. And I think it's important that they make it challenging to get in some ways, because they want to prove people have education and things like that. But it's actually significantly more difficult to get your MLADAC in the state than your LCMHC. And it's more difficult to maintain your MLADAC in the state than your LCMHC. And you get paid significantly more for having your LCMHC, not only by agencies, but also by insurance companies.
And but so you have to invest more in your education and training.
No.
No?
For your LCMHC, for your LCMHC, it's the same. It would be very similar level of education and training.
Both require 60 credit masters.
Yep. And about 2 years post-masters. So when I'm teaching at Keene State, I often get this question from these beginning counselors in the field, like, what license should I get? And there's this huge part of me as a substance abuse counselor, as somebody who's dedicated to this field, that I want to encourage these students to go get their MLADAC. It's so important in the field, and it's very hard for me to make an argument to say, yes, you should go get your MLADAC. And so I think it's a really complicated
issue. Because it's just
issue.
Not worth it?
Well, they're going to make more money in a field that has very little money. And they're going to be able to work with a broader scope of people. And the MLADAC is challenging to get and really challenging to keep.
Let's invite our listeners to join us. And then I have a lot more questions for all of you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the shortage of staff in the field of substance abuse counseling. Join us with your questions and comments, whether you work in this field or have had some experience with it. We'd love to hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800 892-6477. Again, email is exchange@nhpr.org. Emily Corwin is here, NHPR Seacoast reporter who's been looking at this issue. Also with us, Diane Pepin, executive director of the New Hampshire Alcohol and Drug Abuse Counselors Association, and Melissa Chickering, formerly program director at Phoenix House, now a faculty member at Antioch University. Did you want to jump in there too, Diane, on the idea that, without getting too detailed for the general listener, how do you advise people on what sorts of credentials they need and whether it's worth the time and energy?
Well, the biggest thing between LCMHC, LICSWs, and MLADACs.
And again, just untangle the alphabet for us there.
Okay. Mental health counselors versus people who specialize with substance abuse.
Got it.
The difference is the scope of service. So people who are credentialed as mental health counselors or social workers, they can treat a lot of different disorders. Substance abuse can treat substance abuse and co-occurring disorders if there's something happening with the substance abuse. But they aren't necessarily treating the different mental health disorders all by themselves. As an example, if someone has depression, they can go see someone who is a social worker or a mental health counselor. If they have substance abuse with it, they can also see an MLADAC. So there's a different scope of practice that people can service. So often mental health counselors were paid more because they could treat more disorders.
I see.
And so that made them more marketable. But there are about 2,000 of mental health counselors and social workers combined, where there's only about 400 or less of substance abuse specific.
Go ahead, Emily.
Just to throw in there, there's some interesting counterintuitive things about this. For one, usually when you specialize, you get paid more. And it's just, I mean, just as an observer of this, I don't work in the field, but I was surprised. Oh, my gosh, this is like an economic conundrum. Why do you specialize and earn less in substance abuse? And then another thing is that, what was I going to say? Well, another thing that is relevant is sort of just that the licensing, you know, processes are changing. And I don't know when you want to talk about that, but, you know, we should. Like, there are different options for, you know, who can treat substance abuse disorders and what insurance will reimburse. And it's sort of, it seems to me at least, it's sort of, you know, stirring things up in this field a little bit, and there's a lot of uncertainty and confusion around, you know, what license you need and, you know.
And given that, how do you encourage young people, especially, to jump into this field? They may say, oh, it's too confusing, it's a mess, and so forth. What do you say to people, Melissa, in terms of, you know, if they've got an interest but they're not sure?
If they have an interest about getting into the field or if they have an interest about getting licensed?
If they have an interest in just broadly getting into the field.
I think that the field itself is an amazing field to get into. And so one of the reasons that I really love teaching at Keene State and my work at Antioch is because I get to talk to these people who are interested in getting in the field and share my passion for it. And the reason that the field is amazing to get into is because the clients that we work with are amazing. I think that the success stories that we do hear that we don't hear enough blow you away. They're miracles. It's incredible. And so regardless of the pay, regardless of the frustration of the system, regardless of the licensing craziness and all of that stuff, you're saving lives. And you're touching people on a level that, is a miracle. It's
even with the low pay and the 80% relapse rate, you're still telling young people, yeah, this is rewarding work to do.
Absolutely. No doubt.
Diane?
I think a lot of people get into the profession because it's touched their lives. And addiction touches everybody.
Former addicts or families of addicts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You want to make – a person who gets into the profession wants to make a difference. And they want to be able to offer their skills in helping someone. And that's the passion that drives them.
We'll talk more about staff shortages in the field of substance abuse counseling. And let's hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, as overdose deaths continue to climb in New Hampshire, there's been a statewide call for more access to drug treatment, and more funding for it has come through. But despite rising demand, treatment centers, as we're hearing, are scrambling to find and keep enough trained staff. So today in The Exchange, we are looking at this shortage of substance abuse treatment counselors and efforts to ease that shortage. And let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Emily Corwin, Diane Pepin, Melissa Chickering, let's go right to our listeners. And Bob joins us in Concord. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thank you, folks, for trying to help in the recovery field. I just wanted to say that, is there any way of simplifying the I know you need degrees in certain areas, but isn't it basically someone putting down a drink and a drug and getting sober? I've been sober for a long time now, and it took me 10 years to get 29 years of continuous sobriety. And that came from the simplest guy in a free public detox in Massachusetts. And I went to Spofford Hall when I had insurance, when that was around. And sometimes it got very complicated, and all they really needed was to get away from my old friends, the alcohol, the drugs, get into some sort of 12-step program. For me, after repeated tries, I got it. And I don't know if it's me or if it's just getting so complicated. I know several people in the field that I was frustrated, and they're changing now. A couple of them, at least, are changing what they do.
So, Bob, you're asking, does it need to be so complicated? Maybe it's just a matter of getting out of an unhelpful community, if I could put it that way?
Well, yes, and also, I understand you need different steps for different people, and long-term treatment sometimes takes, you know, family involvement and everything like that, but sometimes you just need the person themselves, to get away from the drugs and alcohol and possibly the neighborhood.
Yeah, Bob, thank you so much for calling in, and congratulations, by the way, on your recovery. Diane, what do you think? The idea that, you know, this doesn't need to be so complicated. You just need to get people in the right space at the right time, and they need to make the commitment. I just wonder what you think about those comments.
I think that that's important. It is important that someone is able to access the services when they're ready to hear the message or ready to hear it. And I also think it takes, for some people, many times to try. And maybe the next time they try, they get a little bit further and they stay sober a little bit longer. And the next time they try, it's even longer than that until they're able to put together the long-term sobriety the way Bob did. But along the way, sometimes people get their hopes up, they burn bridges. And it's harder for the general opinion to be able to say, this person can make it. Because they're starting to get disheartened, and they want to see the people make it, and they don't realize that it's a chronic relapsing illness.
I see. So support systems that might have been there in place early on the path, you know, family members get disappointed and frustrated one too many times, and they just say, I'm done with you, and then the person has less resources to hang on to?
It could be. It could be.
Melissa, do you want to jump in on that point or on Bob's point that, you know, maybe we're overthinking this? We talked earlier about all these different licenses and procedures and methods of becoming an addiction counselor, and he's saying maybe it doesn't need to be that complicated.
In some ways, I think he makes really good points. And congratulations, Bob. I think that's great, and I'm glad that you called in. I do think that one of the reasons that I really love working in the addictions field is that addicts tend to be really complex. I mean, people are complex, right? So what works for one person is not necessarily going to work for other people. And the root cause of addiction is usually biological and hereditary, but also has to do with your family support, your coping skills, how you were raised. I mean, it's really, really complicated issue. And so for some people, there's some clients that I worked with that I never thought, to be honest, that they would get sober or that they would go great. You know, like it seemed like a really devastating situation and like a light switch goes off and they do really, really well. But, you know, for the clients that I work with and the students that I teach, one of the things that I like to compare it to is going on a diet, which sounds ridiculously simple. But those of us who have tried to lose weight, we've gone on a diet and you do really well for a little bit of time. And then you're like, man, I could probably eat one brownie, right? Like, it's not that big of a deal. And then eventually something happens. something clicks. And it's not, you know, the stages of change, that process, we've all been there in some way. And it's complicated.
Well, Bob, thank you for calling in. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. As we talk about this staffing shortage in the substance abuse field, joining us now is someone who's been dealing with these staffing issues on a day-to-day basis. We're talking with Amalie Gooding. She's director of Phoenix House in Keene. And Amalie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
How many people do you have on your staff, Amalie?
I have a total of 18, and I have 5 full-time counselors.
5 full-time counselors. And how hard is it for you, Amalie, to get the best people to join you?
Well, I sort of looked over my openings, and it takes an average in the last couple of years, but 6 months for me to fill a position. And when I do have applicants, it's 1 or 2 or maybe 3.
6 months to fill a position. That's a long time.
It is. And so it's, you know, it then forces me to have to keep a couple beds open or not to fill all the slots in the intensive outpatient program. And it's, you know, that it's really, I see its impact on, you know, how I don't even have an intern this year from either Antioch or the undergraduate program, and we've always had interns in the past. So I think it's perhaps less people, you know, getting the education they need, which sort of goes back to what that last caller was talking about. Why do they need all that education? But some of that is required by insurance, and some of it is required by the complexity of the clients who have a lot of co-occurring mental health issues.
When you finally find somebody, Amalie, what are the chances that you'll... Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
When you finally find somebody, what are the chances that you'll keep them for a good long time?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, Phoenix House really works hard at developing their counselors and giving them supervision and allowing them to get licensed, which is at minimum a 2-year process once they're hired. And oftentimes, because of salaries being higher in more urban areas or across the border in Massachusetts or even Vermont, we will often lose people for that reason, as well as the fact that it's, you know, it's a hard job. It's very rewarding, but you have to have a lot of self-care and, you know, there's a high burnout in the field. So, you know, I would say on average, I mean, I pride myself. I have some people that have been here 7, 8, 9 years, but that's not, I would say, the case across the board, nor perhaps the experience of most centers.
Yeah, Emily Corwin gave us some numbers at the beginning of the show talking about how every year 1 out of every 4 people in this field leaves the field because of low pay and high stress.
Yeah. I think it's 1 out of every 4 changes jobs.
Changes jobs.
And
okay.
So there's a lot of turnover, but then there is a lot of people leaving
the
field as well.
Sure. Did you want to comment on that as well, Amalie?
No, I mean, I think, you know, you have Melissa on the show, and she was a wonderful clinician, and I think she's contributing a lot in her new position, but she's not doing direct care. And, you know, I know that, so I, you know, losing those people to the direct care, that's, you know, that's the work in the trenches. And that's the work that I think we need to incentivize it. We need to pay our people better. And, you know, when I had actually had this meeting in Keene with Annie Custer, you know, we were talking about
Congresswoman Custer.
Great.
Yeah,
yes,
go ahead.
Yes, that we should, you know, if we had some sort of incentivizing program like tuition forgiveness if people, you know, would go and practice for, you know, X amount of time in nonprofits to give treatment. I mean, those kinds of things I think would help, because we need more people to get the education to become counselors. I mean, it is a long process. It's, you know, at best it's 3 years post college to become a master's level counselor, which is what is required by private and public insurance, which is, you know, the direction we're going in to have everyone covered so that they can get treatment.
Did you want to jump in, Diane?
When Amalie was talking about there's a pull from other areas for substance abuse counselors, right now there is legislation that's being looked at about getting substance abuse counselors in fire departments, DCYF. Hospitals are being incentivized to enhance their services and increase their services for substance abuse. They're going to need substance abuse counselors. Mental health centers, primary care integrated programs, drug courts, corrections, nurses, colleges. Like, there's a lot of pull for substance abuse counselors. And that doesn't count the number of treatment programs, outpatient, inpatient, IOP, which are the levels of treatment that someone needs, whether they're living at home, seeing someone once a week, or staying in a program for a longer period of time.
Wow. So that long list that you gave, Diane, of places that are going to be wanting, required to have more substance abuse counselors, I just wonder, like, where are these folks going to come from?
It's the pull. And that speaks to what Emily is saying about how people are shifting and moving from job to job.
Got it. Amelie, go ahead. And I'd love your thoughts, too, on where you think this new workforce is going to come from. For example, maybe EMTs will increase their training, or firefighters, or people who are working part time. I just wonder where you think this new group of workers is going to come from.
I don't really have an answer to that. I think that I have quite a few bachelor's level getting licensed as licensed drug and alcohol counselors who don't have a master's but who are quite capable of doing groups and individual counseling, you know, to a great extent. And so I think making better and more use of that level is one way to sort of fill the gap. And, you know, there's also this whole movement of, I don't know if you've talked at all about the recovery coach, which is a sort of a new category of individuals who are, you know, it's peers, and I'm not saying that they'll be able to do treatment, but I don't have an answer, Laura, to say where these new people are going to come from.
Well,
I don't.
Yeah, and I think that's the question we're asking today. So,
yeah.
Amelie, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for asking me, Laura.
Amelie Gooding, again, she's director of Phoenix House in Keene, a nonprofit drug and alcohol rehabilitation organization with facilities in many locations. Again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's go next to Hampton, where Marty's on the line. Hi, Marty. Go ahead.
Hey, Laura. How you doing?
Fine.
Hey, I just wanted to say that, and I think Diane referred to this briefly, but the 1115 waivers are a group of monies that are going to be given to healthcare organizations throughout the state. It'll be about $30 million a year for the next 5 years. And those monies are specifically designed to help create substance abuse and mental health treatment infrastructure. I think it would be a great idea for people in local communities who have concerns about substance misuse to stand up at the public hearings that will be happening across the state and encourage that some of those monies be used to develop a substance abuse counselor workforce throughout the state. And I also think that Amelie's point about looking to the recovery movement as a way as a part of the solution to help build a substance abuse counselor workforce is also a promising idea.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling, Marty. You know, Melissa, I did want to ask you, we do often hear that some of the people who are in this field, I think Diane mentioned this earlier, are people who have experience with addiction themselves. Is that another potential resource to better staff this field?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's always been a resource to staff the field. I think it's also, though, important to note that it's not just having experience in your own life with addiction or recovery that makes you necessarily qualified. And I do think that the education, the license, all of those things are really important. So it makes me a little bit nervous also around the recovery coaches and things like that, that it is really difficult and challenging work, and I would just hope that we wouldn't be heading in this direction where we would be encouraging people to work in this field without the, you know, years of education, years of licensed practice, those type of things.
So to people who say, you know, we need more people and we're overthinking it and we're requiring too many complicated licenses and too many years of investment in education, you would say, okay, let's not let this rising demand make us panic and let people get into this field who maybe don't have the proper qualifications.
Absolutely. Exactly.
Okay, Emily, I can see you want to jump in, and then Diane, go ahead.
So this has been something interesting that I've sort of been observing as I've been researching for the reporting I've been doing. There's a conflict, I think, in the field of substance abuse treatment, which is it started out as largely driven by people in recovery, but it's also been undermined by the perception that it's not a medical field and that it's not a legitimate field to be spending money on. And so as it's become more medicalized, as parity, the idea of parity, which is to treat mental health and substance abuse issues as, you know, the same, deserving the same level of treatment as, you know, like a broken arm or a heart attack, as we've sought to seek, you know, as we seek that and the idea of someone working in the field merely because they're motivated and not also because they're qualified is, I think, a challenge. When you look at the surveys that have been done of clinical directors and why they have a hard time hiring, I believe it's the number one reason is that the people who are applying don't have the qualifications they need. And certainly as insurance reimburses this increasingly, which is a great thing, I think everyone would agree, those insurance companies require these qualifications. And so obviously one would want to take advantage of anyone who's motivated. I would imagine that some of the fear is that in a desperation to take advantage of those people, the field could relapse sort of back to a non-specialized, non-medicalized sort of state, which is for that reason probably more underfunded.
And insurance is requiring people to have those enhanced qualifications.
Right.
Wow. Okay. So Diane, go ahead and jump in, and then Melissa, and then lots of calls.
Emily, that was really well stated. That was really, really well stated. There are different credentials for someone who just wants to get started. And it could be the recovery coach, but it also could be a certification in being a certified recovery support worker. And that is often seen as a way to help mentor someone in looking at, do they want to become a substance abuse counselor and do they want to invest in taking the time? And a lot of agencies will mentor someone in trying to figure those things out.
Do you want to jump in, Melissa, too?
Yeah. So this all, I think those were both really, really good points. And it reminds me of some of the work that I do at Antioch. At Antioch, we have an institute on wellness for helping professionals. And part of our work there is working with counselors that have experienced secondary trauma, which is basically the trauma that you experience working with these really challenging clients, like observing all of their loss, their pain, all of those things. And I think that one of the things that I worry about this sort of like flooding the field with eager people is that it's dangerous work. I mean, it's dangerous. That would be dangerous for the clients, but it also is dangerous for the counselor if you don't have enough experience or education around taking care of yourself as a counselor and what that means. And so it would also worries me around that secondary trauma, which is a real significant thing, I think, in the field of substance abuse counseling.
Secondary trauma, meaning these people have such terrible stories sometimes, and you bring that home with you
exactly
in a meaningful way. All right, we will talk a lot more after a short break. Take a lot more of your calls, emails, comments on Facebook or Twitter. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the severe shortage in substance abuse treatment staffing and efforts here in New Hampshire to ease it. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Melissa Chickering, Diane Pepin, Emily Corwin, let's go right back to our listeners. Anne joins us from Dover. Hi, Anne. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to talk about the experience of a licensed psychologist. psychologists are abundant in the state of New Hampshire, and psychologists are trained 5 years or more beyond the bachelor's level and always in the curriculum for a licensed psychologist involves substance abuse, and psychologists generally treat people with substance abuses. And yet in this program so far, I haven't heard the role of psychologists. As well, psychologists can take all manner of insurances, so therefore can sometimes extend treatment beyond other professional levels. So I'm hoping that maybe people will talk about the role of psychology and psychologists in treating substance abuse. I do want to mention that there has been some kind of a bias, and I don't know a lot, but there have been many psychologists who attempt to go for earlier LADAC or later CADAC certification.
And you're going to have to tell us what that is.
It's a license for drug and alcohol treatment.
Uh-huh.
It's a license in the state of New Hampshire. And now I think it's a certification. But it's something you could go for as a psychologist beyond your license to practice and to treat those with substance abuse. And often psychologists are not allowed to go through that process. In other words, they're failed through that process. And the implication, as I have experienced it, is if you haven't experienced drug and substance abuse yourself, then you're probably not qualified to treat it. That's just simply not a good model. And I'm not saying that's prevalent, but I think there's some of that going on in this state.
So, Anne, if psychologists, as you say, are abundant here in New Hampshire and are qualified to help people dealing with addiction, where's the mismatch then? Because we do hear so much about people wanting treatment and not being able to find someone to take them.
Well, I think a lot of that, number one, they may not be thinking of going to a psychologist, not realizing this is a qualified person who has had an abundance of coursework and training, internship training in treating people with substance abuse. That knowledge may not be out there, which is why I decided to call.
Well, glad you called, and thank you for joining us. Melissa, what do you think? An untapped resource.
I think you do make a lot of good points, and it's interesting because I think licensed psychologists, licensed clinical mental health counselors, licensed social workers, they're all allowed to. Many of them are very skilled at treating substance abuse disorder. In my role at Antioch, I actually am the director of practicum and internships, and so I place students in internship sites, and sometimes those students go on to get their LCMH, their licensed clinical mental health counseling license, as opposed to their licensed alcohol and drug counselor license. And I think what it actually speaks to is yet again another challenge for the licensed alcohol and drug counselors, because what is the incentive to go ahead and get your master's licensed alcohol and drug counselor when there is this abundance of psychologists that can do that work without going through those hoops? And you know what I mean? So I think that it is challenging. I think the other point, though, that I wanted to make is that with licensed alcohol and drug counselors, there's testing, you need to have 2 years of experience in the field. There's a lot of very specific things that license qualifies you to do. And so it's not that licensed psychologists aren't some licensed psychologists that are totally qualified to do that work. It's that the MLADAC after your name it means that you've spent 2 years of really specific practice and passed a pretty challenging exam.
Okay, well, thank you for calling in. And let's go to Jim in Ludlow, Vermont. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange.
Hi, it's good to talk to you this morning. I'm really, really enjoying the show. Your guests are fantastic. I am a former drug and alcohol counselor. I worked in the early 90s for about 10 years. I've done work in detox units, inpatient drug and alcohol treatment centers, et cetera, et cetera. I left the field partially because of the burnout that one of your guests pointed out. It is a high burnout field. But also because the trend toward medicalization led to an emphasis on documentation that became an exercise in, you know, providing all of these copious notes on treatment, and patient care had begun to suffer. And so I do see the sober coach option as an attractive one for me, even though I have some experience, I do have a degree in psychology. The licensing for drug and alcohol hadn't come along yet when I was in the field, but I'm looking to get back into it because I have the experience in a hospital environment, but I really don't want to deal with the amount of documentation that's required in the newly medicalized field of addiction counseling.
Yeah, so part of it was the paperwork, Jim? You just spent so much time pushing papers you couldn't sit down and work with people?
Not so much that. What I saw was a system that was, you know, I was my last job was a continuing care counselor at an adolescent drug and alcohol treatment center. And it was heartbreaking to watch counselors work with somebody for weeks and weeks and to have this constant struggle to provide the treatment and to get the insurance reimbursement. I do think we can all work together, though. I don't see it as an either-or. I think sober coaches need to better liaise with people who are in that environment. And if we all work together, I mean, I think that's the goal. We want to help people. So if we can all work together and find a way to bridge those gaps, I don't think sober coaches are the answer for everybody. Not in my experience, but I do think that there's a role for them.
All right, Jim, thank you very much for calling in. Did you want to jump in on this, Diane?
Well, I think there's one thing that's important to know is that New Hampshire is trying to look at the broader picture, the traditional sources of looking for substance abuse counselors, but also the non-traditional. And psychologists have been overlooked as someone who could be treating that service. One of the places that people can go if they're looking for services and who can they see, there's nhtreatment.org as a website that is the New Hampshire Treatment Locator. And that's a really good resource for people. And it includes different credentials, people who are working in different areas listed on that website.
Well, and
if they're not, they can get added.
Jim called from Vermont. And Emily, I did wonder about the experience of other neighboring states, Vermont, Maine, Massachusetts, and if they've had different approaches from New Hampshire to filling this gap that we're talking about.
Yeah, actually, Melissa, I think it was mentioned to me when we were chatting maybe a month or two ago that, you know, that, like, things are better in Vermont. And I thought that was interesting. I wanted to know if it was true. And I chatted with some people there. I checked out some numbers. And if you talk to a clinical director in Vermont, they'll say, oh, my gosh, this workforce shortage is real. Like, we experience this, too. But if you look at the numbers, Vermont has more, you know, per 1,000 adults with addictions. There's a consulting group that came out with a study. Vermont has the most number of treatment professionals per 1,000 people in need of treatment. And, you know, they have 70 per 1,000. New Hampshire is right at average at about 30. That's significant. And, you know, funding is changing, but back in 2013, I think it is, you know, New Hampshire was spending $8.81 per person on drug treatment. Vermont, let me look this up real quick. Vermont was spending $33. Connecticut, 48.
Wow, big difference.
And huge difference. So the spending is quite different.
Well, and speaking of the money, two emails to that effect. Here's one from Jen, who says, as an LICSW, tell me what that is, Melissa, again.
Licensed Independent Clinical Social Worker.
Okay. In Northern Carroll County, I can tell you that without proper reimbursement and salary, New Hampshire will not retain quality counselors. Jen says, we have no publicly funded beds for secular inpatient treatment and one agency that is woefully understaffed and underfunded. Jen says, without the devotion to publicly funding this effort, it will never change. And then here's another email. Speaking of other states, Stephanie says, my husband was a licensed counselor in Maine and, I might add, made more money in Maine than he does now in New Hampshire. And when we moved to New Hampshire, his license didn't transfer. He petitioned to the board to obtain his New Hampshire license, and he was denied. He has over 15 years of professional experience in the field, but the New Hampshire board apparently has a higher requirement for credit hours than Maine did, and the board is requiring that he must take something like 3 more master's level classes before he can even be licensed. Stephanie says, ultimately, his current employer won't pay him more if he has his license, so there hasn't been any incentive to obtain it. Melissa, this is what you talked about at the beginning of the hour, sort of the push-pull of how much credentialing or education you get versus how much money you make.
Yeah, it's funny. We the licensed alcohol and drug counselors that I know in the state, we sort of joke that New Hampshire is like the toughest state because it is really hard to get licensed here. And then it's really hard to come from another state and get reciprocity. Antioch has done a really nice job of trying to address that. We have a certificate program that counselors from other states or counselors that are trying to get licensed can attend to help them get their license, to help them like make up those extra educational units that they need. But it does make it really challenging because there's really great people that could be working in this field that we then ostracize.
In talking to clinical directors, like at Serenity Place in Manchester, a couple different places, they would say, you know, it's so hard to hire these people. I get an applicant from Massachusetts or an applicant from Maine or Vermont, and it can take, you know, not only just the usual 3 months waiting time to get them through the you know, crossing the border license issue, but then another year for them to get their license in order because of the licensing differences between the states. And New Hampshire does have a higher threshold, although they have the uniform licensing test, they still have a higher threshold for entry. And a lot of people say that that's part of the problem.
A higher bar for licensing here in New Hampshire for substance abuse counselors, then that seems to be what everybody is saying. You know, it's interesting. I've heard from people in all manner of professions that New Hampshire has a high bar for licensing professionals, whether it's substance abuse counselors or hairdressers or anybody. So, and you'd think this is the live free or die state, but I just wonder what that's about, Diane.
I think it's about people in New Hampshire. When we seek services, we want the best services. We don't want to settle for someone who knows part of the issue. We want to see someone who knows what they're doing. And that's why our licensing boards take on the responsibility of making sure the people that they credential really know what they do.
Let's take one more call if we could. Nick is in Manchester. Hi, Nick. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Hi. I'm a clinical psychologist licensed in Massachusetts, but I teach at the University of New Hampshire in Manchester. And I have a lot of students who are interested in going into mental health counseling. And I often find myself sort of stuck in this position where I want to encourage them to pursue their passions and their interests, and yet I'm also aware of how difficult this can be. I'm curious what your guests, and by the way, this is a great show. I'm really enjoying it. I'm curious what your guests would say to students to sort of reassure them that this is going to work out for them, because so many students, I feel like, have the interest, but are often turned off by what they perceive to be a job that's going to not pay them very well, might not be a very good sort of long-term investment, or maybe that they you know, minimal opportunities for growth, that sort of thing.
Well, I'll definitely ask our guests that, Nick, for sure. But what do you say to people?
So I usually encourage students to do what they're passionate about. And we have a great program for getting students to participate in internships at various community agencies in the area that we have great relationships with. So I currently have 8 students at different community placements that I supervise. So I feel like that's the best way for them to kind of learn if this is something that they really want to do, and to learn from others in the field that they're working alongside. But those are usually students who have kind of made the decision that this is something they're really serious about doing. It's more the students who are just sort of contemplating this as a potential career path, where I feel like I have the opportunity to get to them really early on in this decision-making process. I'm just curious to get the perspective of your guests on, you know, what would they say to kind of encourage students to take a chance in this career area?
Well, sure, Nick, and thank you so much for calling in, because this is fundamentally what we're talking about. Go ahead, Melissa.
Nick, it sounds like we're in very similar roles at our universities, and I totally understand and empathize about where you're coming from, because I have some similar questions from my students at Keene State and the students I work with at Antioch. And I think that similar to what you were just saying, I think that talking with students about their passion is really important. Nobody goes into the field of counseling in general to make a lot of money. It's not going to happen. You're not going to walk out a millionaire. But what you are going to walk out with is the ability to touch lives and to save lives and to make great changes in your community. And I think that there's not an amount of money that's worth that. I think about the times in my life that I have worked with a client, and then 5-10 years later, I stumble upon them and they're still doing well. And that is amazing. There's no amount of money that's worth that.
What would you say, Diane, to that possibly aspiring student?
I would encourage them. I would say that there's lots of demand for substance abuse counselors, that because of that increased demand, there's also an increase in pay that's happening. Recently, there was a large treatment program held a job fair to get substance abuse counselors, and they were advertising a start of $55,000. So things are changing.
Things are shifting.
And then with students that want to get in, there are different points of entry. So they can enter with an associate's level. They can enter with a bachelor's. They can enter with a master's degree. They can get in at different levels depending on how eager they are to get in and what depth of service they want to be able to treat.
How about the state of New Hampshire, Emily? What efforts broadly are being made at the statewide level to address this shortage?
So in October, last October, the state added LADAC. So that's the addiction counselor with no master's degree, and the master's level, MLADAC, these degrees to a list of medical education pursuits that qualify you to apply for tuition reimbursement. Now, there's not enough money to go around, and it's very specific. You have to be in, like, a very particular part of the state working with, like, you have to have really particular qualifications. So it's not easy to get, but that's one effort. You know, the state is saying, all right, there's a need, and we're going to try to put money toward this. I think, you know, there's a lot of people saying scholarships, tuition reimbursement at the national level, at the state level, more, you know, increasing that would be a really good way to change the balance that kids have to think about, or, you know, young adults have to think about when they think, is this worth it to go into?
Okay.
The state just got $150 million grant from the Medicaid, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, and that's going to, you know, go toward a whole new kind of care throughout the state.
Okay. All of you, lots more to talk about. Thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan, and I'm Laura Kanoy.